is a subject that's basic to all of Torah understanding and basic to life. Perhaps one of the most important subjects. Hard to think of an area that is more critical to understand in terms of being successful in life than this message. It's a wonderful example of a principle that is taught in the deeper wisdom, Kabbalistic sources specifically, and that we can follow through in Torah history and development of the Jewish people, and also in the development of all inner experience. Let's try to identify that and see it through. We're now reading the parshas in the Torah, we're now learning those sections in the Torah that deal with the beginnings, the very beginnings of the Jewish people. And as this follows through, this theme is one of the most important, and therefore one of the most important in the development of everything that is Jewish history and the life of every individual Jew, and in fact every human being. First of all, if you read those sources that talk about these deeper ideas, there's an idea that, again, to understand these things in their source is probably impossible for us, but let's note at least what the deepest level of Torah wisdom teaches, and then we'll see if we can begin to understand it by considering its application. Be very careful with these ideas, because the words are always borrowed. Anything that you have from the deeper level of Torah teaching is always an idea that is, by definition, it is beyond words. The words themselves are only, you know, when we talk about the secret wisdom, the fourth level of depth or derivation in any Torah subject, that area is called Sod. Sod means the secret level. But the other level, the simple level, that's the first one, the level of the that which is hinted or perhaps learned by derivation, that's a second level. A third level is a very deep level that needs to be, deep work needs to be done to bring it out. And the fourth level is called Sod. Sod, that voyage, that journey into what's known as the orchard of Torah, Parnes, that fourth level is known as the secret world, the Kabbalistic world, the world of secret. People think that which is a secret, again, we hear all these things exactly the opposite to the way they should be heard. We think that which is secret because you haven't been told. To the English ear, English-speaking ear, we think that which is secret, wisdom, is secret because it's been kept secret. In other words, no one's told you. And that's why we refer to it as a secret. A secret is that which has not been divulged. Meaning that if someone would tell you, then you'd know about it. So the picture you have is that there's a wisdom which underlies all wisdom. It's known as a secret wisdom. And it's esoteric. It's an esoteric wisdom. You don't know it. People don't tell you that secret. You need a lot of qualifications before someone will teach you. But if you have those qualifications, one day, you'll learn Torah for many years, you'll be married, you'll be over 40, and you'll have... That concept we have is that it's a secret wisdom. When you have those qualifications, and you have that level of depth and maturity, then somewhere in some forgotten corner of the old city of Yerushalayim, you'll find someone who will let you into the secret, or tell you the information, then you'll know it. It's a very serious misconception. The concept is not that it's secret wisdom that no one told you, and when they tell you, you'll know it. In Torah, the words always describe the essence of a thing. If something is secret because no one told you, then it's not essentially secret. The concept, again, you have to think about it more carefully than that. If the word secret is used, it means that the wisdom is intrinsically secret, which means that no one could ever tell you. That means there aren't any words. It's not that someone didn't tell you yet. It means it's that wisdom that doesn't live in words. Nobody could ever find the words to tell you. It's that which you must discover on your own. That's what it means. That's why in the tradition that is handed down about these things, it says that the master tells his disciple only the general headings or the general areas. And then he has to figure out for himself, he has to work out for himself the depth of the material, because it cannot be put into words. And therefore one has to be extremely careful about the words that are used to convey the wisdom, because by definition those are not the words. In other words, what we're saying is, if you hear the words used and you think you've understood, then for sure you haven't understood. But if you feel confused and you haven't grasped it, then there's a possibility that you may in fact. That's the nature of the subject. And there's an idea that says as follows. I'm careful now because not to use the words out of their proper place. But it says in the sources that deal with these things that every time a light shines, it shines twice. But the light shines once, and that in fact is an illusion. The light then gets taken away, and it shines a second time, and that is the time that is meaningful. But it couldn't shine the second time unless it was there the first time. So it says, it's called the first light and the second light. Yeah, very deep Kabbalistic ideas. And it's a fundamental concept that all the deeper sources use in many different ways. First there's a darkness. The darkness is illuminated by light. Can't have a light unless there's darkness first. How the darkness develops is another story. We don't talk about that now. But there's a light that shines the first time. But by definition, that light cannot last. The reason it can't last is because the sources say that it doesn't belong there. It's a light that belongs in a higher place and therefore goes back to where it belongs. It leaves certain things behind. There's a lot of detailed information here. And then the second time the light shines, it's the light that belongs in this place. In fact, the function of the first light is to open up the place. And the second light shines in, and that's where it belongs. Now, a lot of detailed discussion in the sources that talk about these things, and the Kabbalists throughout the ages have worked with these concepts. But let's try to take the approach this evening of working out the application of this idea. And let's see how it fills itself out, how it applies throughout Torah history and Torah thinking, and see if we can bring it down to our own application in our own lives. Let's perhaps try to identify it. We've identified it in its pure source, in abstraction. Let's try to identify it in its historical source and see if we can generalize from there. If we look at the formation of the Jewish people, obviously anything that happens throughout our history must be located in the moment of our formation. And I believe we've studied together in this forum the idea that everything that happens must have happened before. That in the development of a child, all is laid down in the moment of conception. When you see a pregnancy of a child developing throughout pregnancy, you see that all the features that the embryo develops, they must have been coded for in the genes. All that's happening in this process of development is what was laid down in the genes. In fact, the same sources say that the first light is the light that generates the conception, and the second light is the light that generates the development throughout the pregnancy. The one is the flash that begins the process, and the second is the process itself. If the Jewish people are formed by certain events, then it must be that those form the genes, if you like, of what we are, and we must find those same events reflected throughout everything that we've ever experienced. Let me make it practical and see if we can understand a bit better. Stay with me carefully. What happens when the Jewish people are formed? And we're taken out of Egypt. And the process was one of a light being shone. And at the moment of greatest uplift, the light was taken away. And then there was a process of developing the light a second time in a completely different way. Now, let's try to work that out. In Egypt itself, in Mitzrayim, right, the Jewish people were enslaved. It was a time of tremendous darkness. Again, there's always the darkness before the light shines. In fact, the word Mitzrayim, if you think about it carefully, the word Mitzrayim, which means Egypt, right? In English, the word Egypt means Egypt. But in Hebrew, Mitzrayim means a place of straitened circumstances. Mitzrayim in Hebrew means to be squeezed where there's no room for spiritual development. There's no possibility of transcendence. In fact, the same deeper sources say that the word Mitzrayim spells Metzar Yam. Metzar Yam means a constriction of the 50. 50 in Hebrew is always that which denotes transcendence, right? There's 49 gates or 49 levels to the manifest or revealed world. The 50th is that which transcends them completely. Mitzrayim is the place in which the 50th, that means the spiritual development, I'm sure your minds are racing ahead of me, right? You didn't come this evening just to listen passively. I'm sure you're listening actively and your mind's already racing ahead. and your minds have already raced ahead to the process of the Exodus, and how many days did it take to reach the Sinai experience? 50 days, that's what you were about to say, right? 50 days. After the experience of darkness in Egypt, the Torah was given on the 50th day. That means there were 49 stages of development in the desert, and the 50th was the moment of transcendence. Torah is beyond all limitation. Torah is not the 50th step, it's that which is beyond all steps. It's essential to know this. You know that 49 days of Sfirah, so when we count the 49 days of Sfirah, right? We count. We count from Pesach to Shavuot, right? From Pesach to Shavuot, we count 49 days. The Torah says count 50 days. Tisburu Chamishim Yom. The Torah says absolutely explicitly count 50 days. And nothing could be clearer. It's an absolutely explicit instruction. Count 50 days. And how do we do it? The first night we get up and we count, this is day one. The second day we count, this is day two. We pray the instruction literally. When it gets to the 50th day, we say nothing. On the 50th day, which is Shavuot itself, on that Chag, we don't count the 50th day of the Omer. Why do we only count 49? Are you with me? Why do we only count 49 days when the Torah says count 50 days? It says count 50 days. We count 49, we say nothing on the 50th. Why? Because it's basic to Torah understanding that the 50th is not a number. It's the concept of transcending number. It is that which is beyond all number. And therefore, the way we count the 50th day is by not counting it. By not giving it a number. If you gave it a number, then it would be one more than 49, just like 49 is one more than 48. You would be limiting it to a finite point on the line of numbers. And the whole concept of the 50th is that it's the spiritual meaning of that idea, is that it's that which transcends anything that can be quantified. And therefore we count 49 days, and when we enter the zone of the 50th, which is that which is beyond number, obviously we don't give it a number. We fulfill the instruction. Understand this? We fulfill the instruction to count 50 days, right? By not counting the 50th. It means we've now arrived in that zone which is Shavuot, the giving of the Torah, which is Torah itself, which is by definition that which transcends all boundaries, all limits and all limitations. That is the concept of 50. Now the word sea, the word for an ocean in Hebrew is Yam. Right? Yam, the ocean. The letters of Yam are Yud Mem, which is 50. Remarkable thing. The Torah says, Aruka me eretz mida, it's measure. Understand? Again, if you speak another language other than Hebrew, you can't begin. And if you don't have control of, you don't have insight into the original text itself, then Torah is a very, 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 very superficial, almost meaningless image and reflection of itself. The Prophet says, Aruka me eretz mida, the length of the Torah is longer than the land, Urechava min hayam, and it's broader than the sea. So the unschooled ear hears a poetic expression. Torah is so vast that it's longer than all the land and it's broader than all the sea. But there's nothing poetic in Torah. Torah is all poetry. But it's poetry that has all meaning. And if you look carefully at the verse, Aruka me eretz mida, the word mida in Hebrew, which means a measure, adds up to 49. That's